reconvene the hearing. Ms. Black.
Journeys Limited has a considerable amount of infrastructure such as wharves, wastewater treatment plants, water supplies, snow making equipment and electricity generation plants that do not fit within the definition of a building or electricity transmission, distribution or telecommunication line infrastructure in the proposed district plan. Nevertheless, Realty Journeys believes it should be possible to make minor modifications to our diverse infrastructure without seeking resource consent approval. For instance, in the past, the TSS Earnslaw has damaged a single wharf in Queenstown Bay, and when it was repaired, the repair was not like for like. Additional bracing and reinforcings incorporated into the wharf to enable the wharf to take future hard knocks without damage. Also, for example, because of the presence of Lake Snow and Lake Waipatipu, it is likely Real Journeys will need to install upgraded water filter systems at Water Peak to prevent our water pumps from becoming clogged by the Lake Snow Albie. Such water filters will need to be readily accessible, and it might not be practical to have them located below ground. That is, factors in our operation are constantly changing, and in addition, engineering and safety standards are ever evolving, which often requires modifications to be made to infrastructure, such as handrails now need to be installed on parts of walls where jetties would never have had handrails in the past. Consequently, we contend that the proposed district plan should enable minor changes to private infrastructure without going through a resource consent process, especially to accommodate changing engineering and health and safety standards. Accordingly, for the avoidance of doubt, Real Journeys asserts that the minor upgrading definition in the proposed district plan should be expanded to provide for upgrades for more than electricity transmission and distribution or telecommunication lines. Natural hazards. Real Journeys already operates in areas that have the potential to be subject to natural hazard risks. Hence, we support the changes to policy 28.3.1.3, and we are appreciative that the Council has recognised that landowners with existing developments cannot minimise the risks in some locations to a negligible level.
Two questions. Do you have any words as to what a minor upgrading definition should say?
Well, I think maybe we can pull some of the words out of the heritage chapter where it does specify to a degree what a minor repair or upgrade is, but it's quite building specific. But how you build in this whole thing with the changes you have to make around health and safety, where things that in the past you would never have thought about needing to put a barrier in place or something in place, you have to now.
And I suppose the other question is, the definition A minor upgrading will only, is one thing, but what are the, like, I'll ask an open question because I haven't read them. Do the rules that apply to, for instance, wharfs and other structures on the lake bed or lake shore provide for minor upgrading?
It's the, as far as I can tell, the plan is silent on that. And particularly now that we own the Conville wharves, that if vessels change, like Queenstown Water Taxi gets a different vessel, often you have to make structural changes because the rubbing strips, boarding stairs, things like that are in the wrong place. And because it's such in public place, you know, people do come along and say, oh, have you got the concept?
Well, just on that one.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you planning advice, but I'm going to suggest that you get some, because in the Queenstown Town Centre zone, as the council reply version of the rules are, it appears that walls and jetties that are new are a discretionary activity. But it says that all things not otherwise listed are permitted. So that might be the answer.
But what about...
Yes, over at Walter Peak, separate because it's so rural.
Yes.
And yes, I don't have... that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm not giving you any advice on this.
Okay.
But I'm just raising that in terms of that wall.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yes, thank you. I understand the issue.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. That's fine.
My apologies for being slightly late.
No, that's okay. Well, in fact, we're not. You were a minute early still.
Oh, good.
Okay, I'm trying getting ready.
Thank you. That's great. Good job. Quite a few roadworks on the way in.
Jeez, I was discussing the traffic.
Fortunately, that's not the subject I'm having to address.
I think there's an expectation from the council that the regional council will assist in addressing that.
I'll keep them up in here.
Okay. Now we have Mr. Henley's evidence pre-circulated.
Yes.
And were you going to present a summary of it, or?
Through the chair, I'm happy to. Probably ideally, from my perspective, if it's all right, if I could read that, or if you're quite familiar with it, I'm happy to address any specific aspects you'd like to. Obviously, I'm not Mr. Haley, and he's more familiar with it than I am, but I have read it, and I'm happy to speak to it.
Okay. So we can do that if you speak to it, and then give it a little while. We have the rest of the afternoon.
All right. Well, thank you. Also, for a start, I introduce myself as not being Warren Hanley. I'm Ralph Edison. So I'm currently a planner with the Otago Regional Council. And I worked on the regional policy statement prior to taking up a consent position in Alexandra. So I have some familiarity with the process of developing the regional policy statement, and I was involved in some of the formulation of the policies themselves through that process as well. So I wasn't specifically writing any of the or doing any specific work on that natural hazards section. I also previously worked in Queensland Lakes District, so I am familiar with the specific area as well. So if I move past that, just briefly to the scope of evidence. The regional policy statement was undertaken in a process where we understand the district plans were being developed at the same time, so there's been a bit of a to and fro in terms of our development, which has always been quite challenging for both parties to make sure we could align as well as possible, and we had extensive consultation with QODC through that process to try and kind of facilitate that process. And of course, there's supposed to be challenges, naturally. So in terms of natural hazards management, that is obviously a key area of interest to the regional council. And the importance of managing natural hazard risk is one which I think nationally we've been putting a lot more attention to than has previously been the case because of the recent events, and not so recently more, but in Christchurch and internationally in terms of how hazards can impact on wider communities and the impacts in terms of planning long-term and financial impacts that occur as a result, and the lessons that those events have had to our need for greater long-term planning. And so from a regulatory point of view, we kind of acknowledge that it's a matter of actually kind of keeping the public aware of what those natural hazard risks and commensurate planning for them, and developing appropriate planning responses to those matters. So the decisions versions of the proposed regional policy statement was released on 1 October, and there's been a number of appeals in relation to that, some specifically relating to natural hazard provisions, and I understand QODC is a Section 274 party to that. The OIC has currently been undergoing mediation around those issues, and its mediation is expected to be concluded around about June. Obviously, that's the year, as those processes always are. So if I move on to the specific comments around the Section 42A report that Warren's identified. And overall, the Regional Council is quite supportive of a lot of the changes that the district has made. There is far greater focus on awareness of natural hazards, and we think that's been identified as well. The report writer kind of identifies with both the, as I said earlier, both the PRPS and the district plan are at different stages of development, and we do have to kind of try to align that, and that may result in some subsequent changes depending on which document comes out first and what the final status of the regional policy statement is, due to the requirement to get the effect of it now. And so the report, for start, Warren sought to address a number of issues that were raised in the Section 42A report, and in particular, they were around some bullet points that the author raised around them. So I'll just go through those in quick detail. The first one was around the significant risk and the definition of significant. And it was one thing, one of those areas that we spent quite a bit of time trying to work out is there an effective way of defining significant, which is more useful than actually relying on the common, the common English definition of it. And in the end, kind of, it wasn't a specific definition of significant, wasn't added to the PRPs. because of that reason that you can end up kind of creating a definition that no longer aligns with common understanding and can actually be kind of less effective than more. And the common approach in terms of our consenting is to use the common English definitions as if there is no specific definition of plan, and Warren identified that as being a reasonable approach to be taken in terms of the interpretation of policies with that in mind. And that seems to be the approach which the court applies when they're protesting any words which they are not specifically referenced in the plan, if they think they need to be. They'll assess the common understanding in terms of what they are defined as. Yes, it's naturally kind of developing reviewing plans and assessing kind of actual consents. But there's a process of identifying and kind of assessing the nature of natural hazards. And the greater the effects of the natural hazards, obviously the commensurate planning response must address them too. So there's that sense of what significance is, and that's how it's intended that those policies are applied. But in some cases, the natural hazards we identify can be relatively easily addressed. So in terms of saying whether consent is required, if it's a standard approach, we do think that that common definition actually does give planners a reasonable means of assessing what the policies mean in terms of the natural nature of the hazard that it relates to, and just in the similar manner that other matters of national importance are actually identified as well, and how they are assessed and how important they are, it is undertaken in a similar manner. One also notes that the word significance is used in reference to increasing risk, and there's a line between risk and impact and natural hazards. And if the assessment of an activity determines natural hazard risk will be increased, and it's sufficiently increased so as to be noteworthy, as is in the definition, then we could consider that the policy would be considered to apply to the policy 4.1.6. And the person charged with making the decision will be able to put weight on that policy to determine the degree to which this impact is relevant. And moving on to that increasing the risk, the point two that was identified in that 42A report concerns the PRP is inhibiting further development in existing built areas which are subject to natural hazard risk. And again, a lot of the standard responses in terms of planning and so forth to natural hazards now kind of talks about the impacts of the degree of risk and impact as different measures of whether a natural hazard is something that needs to be considered, and items which may have a very low risk may not be considered the same weight as ones which have a high risk. And so, I'll go almost to the point there, this relates to policy 4.1.6, where the decisions version of PRPs. Should any proposed development be able to demonstrate the natural hazard risk will not be significantly increased by the development, then the PRPs will not apply and the threshold will not be triggered. So it's just, again, how it can be applied. It's not a very absolute approach. And in terms of tolerability, again, the point was raised, and kind of referred to the need for further clarification of the concept of tolerability in sections of 6.6 to 6.8 of the order, and so the QLC order, note that this addresses in particular where 6.7, where they concluded the concept of tolerance is an important addition to the district plan, and the district plan picked up the concept of tolerance and then included that in it. And for risky areas for natural hazards facing the community can identify the degree of tolerance and its ability to accommodate or tolerate those risks, which can vary to some extent. I think it does need to be assessed at the community level though, as opposed to an individual level, and that's one area where I think the OIC may have a slight difference in perspective from the district in terms of how that's been applied. So tolerance may vary from community to community depending on the nature of the risk profile and the resources of the community to manage it. But as I said, the regional council does tend to have a different view in terms of an individual indicating they feel they have a higher tolerance to risk and the impact they may have on the community as a whole. Hazard consideration. So point six that was raised in the report related to having greater flexibility within Queensland Lakes District in terms of policy that relates to consideration of hazards in the local context. supported flexibility on a case-by-case basis, so you know, when a consent may be assessed. I guess there was a concern that was the connotation suggesting a complete different set of criteria in terms of natural hazard risk in Queensland Lakes District as opposed to the rest of Otago. And you know, we'll probably identify that Queensland is an area where there are significant natural hazards, which is quite true that this began in New Zealand. It's quite common for the areas to have significant numbers of natural hazards, and many of our other districts actually also face a number of different natural hazards, such as Dunedin faces, you know, flooding and sea level rise and you know, instability on hill slopes. And you know, when we assess each of our districts, we do find you know, similar situations exist. So Queensland's not really a unique situation in that respect. Natural hazards are actually quite common in a lot of our developed urban areas, largely because of the nature of where we tended to build. That land that we tended to reclaim a lot, and so they have tended to be areas we've subsequently identified as being you know, prone to either flooding or liquefaction or a number of other things. And so we do have a concern that Queensland isn't a different set of circumstances and shouldn't necessarily be considered as you know, unique in that context that hazards you know, do relate quite well. In section 6.1 of the report states that chapter 28 introduces a risk-based policy framework, as is identified that policy 4.1 of the proposed RPS. And it's important that it's not a location-based framework, which is very important to go back to. Among other issues, location and context can be considered within the provisions of the relevant objectives of the policies, but the outcomes of the framework is for part of the purpose of the natural asset management, as is required in section 31A, B1 of the RMA. And then from where I'm going to want to kind of identify the specific policies and provide comments on them. Would you like me to go on and do that now, or do you have any specific questions?
I don't think we need to go through those in detail. I do have a question that comes up with your last point about the same question that I just popped in as a blowby yesterday. You said that the issue of natural hazard risk can well, that every part of Otago has risks. Isn't it true, though, that the Queensland Lakes District, with its proximity to the Alpine Fault and the Kondrona Fault running right through a large part of it, there's probably no part of this district that is not subject to some form of natural hazard?
I guess it depends on the scale at which you're talking. You know, I mean, if you look at district plan maps in terms of where hazards are identified, you'll find significant areas where there are no natural hazards identified. That doesn't mean that they'll be not susceptible to an earthquake, which could.
But isn't that quite precise the point that if you go to Dunedin, what is the probability of an earthquake in Dunedin affecting?
Well, there are a number of earthquake fault lines in Dunedin, or proximity to Dunedin, and substantial areas of Dunedin are liquefaction zones. The entirety of South Dunedin, most of North Dunedin, quite a few of the hill areas are also susceptible. So, a similar situation can be seen to Christchurch. Central Otago has a number of fault lines through it as well. So, you know, it's definitely, Queensland definitely has a focus, and its proximity to the Alpine Fault is key here. Fully aware that you know, there's a combination of events which could occur as a result of some of those events, such as you know flooding and backing up and so forth. But there is you know I mean large areas of fractured flats, although they're identified as potential liquefaction zones, the groundwater level is substantially below the surface, and so in practical terms, you know when people have done engineering assessments, they see well the liquefaction assessment is low, despite the fact that they are a type of gravel that might be prone to it if the water level is higher. So there are quite a few areas where,
But doesn't that lead to the issue that if you have a policy that requires landowners who wish to do things to evaluate the risk and to only, there is only an issue if there's a significant risk or a significant increase in risk, that essentially every landowner is going to have to do that work, aren't they? So because, as you've just said, the database isn't accurate, and so essentially requirement that a risk-based evaluation does require everyone to do some evaluation to determine the extent to which they need to deal with that risk.
Well, to some extent, that is what the... I mean, ideally, the plan itself provides a degree of a lens to focus where that assessment should occur. And from a regional council perspective, in many ways, having a reference to documents such as, a hazards register and assessments indicating whether... Well, I mean, I can know the argument goes both ways between whether you actually have hazards identified in the district plan maps, which is quite problematic because you'll constantly have to update them because the nature of hazards is... there's a good level of knowledge to some extent, but it's constantly being refined, and it can be more focused as the aggregate level goes down. So that's hazards advantages, but in terms of some degree of certainty, but it's a significant administrative addition. Then obviously the next step is looking like a hazard register, which is, exists, and it's a body of work which you can use if you have assessment that is saying anything which occurs where there may be a hazard may need to have a greater level of attention paid to it. So you actually have some focus in terms of rules around what may occur, those things, and so the policies and some assessment can apply. Gives you a focus of where there is exactly, where there is actually knowledge now that there is a hazard that needs to be assessed. And if you go beyond that and say, well, we're not going to provide any specific information, then I think you're in a position which you're alluding to where you almost need to be doing assessment for everything because you're not sure if there is a risk there or not.
Well, isn't that the point? Because the hazard register is not authority. It's not the...
Well, that's right, but it's not. I think it's not necessarily a document that should be ignored because it's not permitted. If you're building on the best level of information you have at the time, then it's not appropriate to actually try and get assessments using that information when possible so that you can actually take that into account. I guess that would be an area where the regional council has a concern of, there's an increasing density and move to permitted activities where you are not actually assessing those registers to actually determine whether or not those things should occur. And you are actually potentially increasing the level of people living in the area at risk, and you're relying on such as the Building Act to provide protection for them or the sites around them, which may not be well suited to do so.
So do actually. I'll start with your initial statement, Mr. Henderson. You said, well, and this is paraphrasing Mr. Henderson, we'll just treat that as your own, for convenience, that national importance on hazard risk is increased substantially. Now, I think you referred to the Christchurch earthquakes, and you'd have to come out from under a rock not to understand that everyone is focused on earthquake risk. But has the probability of risk changed, or just the perception of it?
Well, I guess that's an interesting perspective in itself, isn't it? I mean, the risk isn't changed by our perception of it, except to some extent in terms of that relates to how we're going to spend on actually avoiding it and mitigating those things. You can see what the impact of the perception of risk has in terms of what people do after the event. The constant reevaluation of the risk of, even the other day, they reevaluated the risk and the frequency of the outline fault again. It's very difficult to actually find the third ground, excuse the pun, in terms of where the natural hazard information stands. So I think we find that changing quite frequently. But in general, no, those hazards have existed before. In many cases, were developed on land which is subject to natural hazards, either in the clearance of them or gardens, because that was what was the least available at the time.
Well, where that takes me is the deep philosophical question, which is, have we gone, we as a community, gone from a position where we were too blasé about natural hazard risks to a point where we're now overreacting to them? Like the pendulum swings from you react to them at one end and you swing through and you're now overreacting.
Oh, I don't think it's the October Review Council's perspective is not to go to that extreme. I think the policies that we have and the regional policy statements is intended as an enabling document, but it does identify key focuses which the enabling development should be an Australian heritage to determine, you know, whether it's appropriate and what the nature of it is appropriate. And in terms of hazards, you know, this uses kind of the phrase avoid, but it does couch that within a framework which provides opportunities for developments still to occur if the hazard level, you know, is not as significant as maybe initially thought, or if it can be addressed. And so I think that's a key focus for areas like Queenstown, because, you know, as we well know, you know, certain parts of Queenstown are built and faced with one form of hazard or another. And some areas, you know, we think that would be better not intensified. In your parts of Gorge Road, you know, there are significant challenges, particularly if that was left on individual property owners to address. They really simply can't address, you know, issues such as emulsion and the, you know, sale movement of your fans, you know, on an individual property basis. But within that, if it's taken in a broader scope, then it may be appropriately addressed. And so that's, you know, where the regional council has some concerns that those areas and those matters can be addressed at the right scale. And if you're actually looking at individual site scale, then often that can't be done. The means to undertaken to mitigate the hazard effect on the site itself without consideration of those sites around it may actually exacerbate the hazard on the surrounding sites. And it does need to be questioned whether, you know, that's appropriate.
I can understand the concept of not allowing an individual to decide whether they tolerate a hazard risk, especially an individual who's probably going to flick off the land to someone else. The question, the reason I asked you the deep philosophical question, is that if we're all hypersensitized to earthquake and liquefaction risk, is there a danger that having a test of what the community will tolerate is not actually going to objectively weigh the risk? That at the, like, pre-Christchurch earthquake, as I say, I think the community at large would have tolerated any number of things because it wasn't conscious of the risk that it was in fact running. And now, nobody will turn around without thinking about whether the earth is solid under their feet. So is there an issue with, as say, community tolerance, because ultimately the community is not rational, and not rational, and I'm not meaning to decry the ability of people to make judgments, but people have inbuilt biases. And if you didn't have to live through Christchurch, you just had to look at it on TV, and you'd have to be less than human not to make the appropriate reaction, thinking, well, could this happen to us?
Yeah, look, I fully agree. As I was coming in right in, because I was thinking about Christchurch, too, I was thinking of different contexts. I was thinking about whether I built Christchurch in the first place, and actually, you know, they reclaimed the swamp. and the most powerful body at the time was, you know, the drainage board, which was actually kind of draining it and, you know, provided significant modification of it. And at the time, they kind of reassessed everything. Well, this is, you know, what everything is, and so it's quite appropriate to do it. But I guess the context of that community setting its own limits is focused through the process of the community setting its own sense of tolerability, and then it's going through a process such as this where that level of tolerability is put into a document that has to meet the various statutory roles and purposes of the body that puts it into effect, and that was council. And so that sense of tolerance is, you know, tested through the, you know, important expert evidence and the advice of other people to consider, like, what are the impacts of what we're fighting on the long term. And I think that's where, you know, those other thinking about, you know, current generations and future generations becomes quite key when we're talking about long term impacts such as natural hazards.
I'm just trying to get a sense of how in fact you establish what the community's sense of tolerability is. You said through consultation, but to me, do you really get a sense, you won't get an expert-informed view. If you consult with people, you'll get, in a number of cases, you get a gut instinct, or gut reaction, perhaps a knee-jerk reaction. Depends on the person. And so how would that, how, because the regional council has written this concept tolerability into the proposed RPS as a litmus test. How in fact is that going to work in the application of these policies?
Well, I think in the context of the original policy statement, it's providing a direction for the various different policy documents which are delivered underneath it, and you know, district plans are, you know, the lens in which you're focusing the views of your community and the feedback on natural hazards. And again, as we just said, you know, that's, that has to be tested through expert input as well in terms of what's appropriate. And so in the need context, they're thinking about, okay, well, what do we do with sounds of need in this area, which they have concerns about, you know, signal reliance and flooding and so forth. You know, do we extend a longer term occupation of that? And do we make planning kind of steps to make that continued occupation acceptable? Because it's already so developed, or do they, you know, think about, you know, resettlement and other steps like that to address it sooner rather than later? And it brings down this, you know, what level of intensity you incur, you allow in particular areas, and how you will manage those communities, and whether you will fund that to address the natural hazards on those sites. So, I mean, there are a range of different tools that each council can undertake to do so. But the district plan is a process we like. You know, you go through community consultation, don't you? When you get a sense of, like, an engineer out of the natural hazards chapter, you provide the opportunity for people to have feedback on it and put it into it. And again, you've done an expert testing of that. So that's really, I mean, this original policy statement is it providing a strategic direction to how other councils should try this.
What I take from that is the advice we have from council staff is that the district plan objectives and policies should themselves reflect that guidance from the RPS and have tolerability tests. The sense I have from your answer is perhaps that's not right, and the district plan ought to be deciding now what's tolerable and what's not, rather than putting that off for another day.
Well, I guess there's a, you can cut that a number of ways, isn't it? Because to some extent you're doing a tolerability test in terms of your zoning, and in other situations you may be doing a tolerability test in terms of the assessment of a consent, in terms of which has a natural hazard role in that. I couldn't speak more specifically on that because, unfortunately, you know, I haven't had that level of involvement where your plan has gone most recently, so I don't think I could speak beyond that.
But if you have a resource consent application and it's a subdivision consent, and it may be a controlled or restricted discretionary activity, and there's a natural hazard assessment and it's not notified because they're rarely notified, how is the district council supposed to ascertain what is the community's level of tolerability in respect of that natural hazard assessment?
You mean through the regional policy statements, policies, or through your own policies?
I'm just saying, in reality, yeah, irrespective of what document we're talking about, in reality, how does the decision maker determine what the community's level of tolerability is?
Yeah, I can see the challenge in that in terms of your councillors themselves have a degree of, you know, will they represent the community to some extent themselves, but in terms of what guidance is there beyond the policies, as we were indicating.
But if it's non-notified, the decision maker may well be a council officer. And even if it's notified, it's more likely to be an independent hearing commissioner than a councillor who may come from outside the district. And I'm just wondering where you're suggesting that when it's a resource consent application, these policies enable that level of tolerability to be determined. I'm wondering how that decision maker can do that.
Well, particularly if you're, as you say, particularly if you're, there are no other parties involved, then you, it's, yeah, can see the challenge in terms of how you're going to determine what the community view is at your own level, because you are providing a level, a degree of opinion, aren't you, on that.
Supposedly, even if it's a notified consent, how do you know that what you have, as soon as you have, are in fact a representative sample of the community at large?
Well, of course, that's always the case, isn't it? I mean, I see the policies around tolerability providing a better guidance at a zoning type level when you are actually able to get a wider feel for what the community may want and what the direction they seek is. But given the scale of some of the consents, that creates a similar challenge.
Change the subject a little. Discussion yesterday with Ms. Mobis. You've taken the position, or Mr. Hanley did, and you've adopted it, that it's not appropriate to talk about what's acceptable. We should follow what's tolerable as per the language of the proposed RPS. The question we discussed yesterday is there a difference? Is there a substantive difference between what's acceptable and what's tolerable?
I'm not that familiar with the current ruling of the RPS in terms of where the definition's at, because I stopped working before this version came out, so I couldn't speak to the current definitions in the RPS in terms of tolerability, what is actually currently defined.
But step back from the document. Would you say to us that they are different concepts? There is a material difference?
If you're thinking in general terms, there's something acceptable or something tolerable. They're a similar concept. Yeah.
And the reason we discussed it yesterday is because the operative RPS uses acceptable, the proposed RPS uses tolerable, and we're required to give effect to the operative RPS at less than until the new one is operative.
Yeah.
So deciding that they're very similar is a helpful end result, because then we don't have to worry about it.
But I think to some extent the use of the word tolerable rather than acceptable came about because there's a degree of planning literature out there providing guidance on terminology for describing natural hazards and that's the risk matrix and so forth, and that use of tolerability. So there's a desire to actually be relatively consistent with other directions that were coming out, rather than kind of mixing the language, which always becomes difficult when you move from one plan to another. But that was at the time that I was involved in.
Now, in terms of the discussion, there's something else I didn't understand, and you've summarised it. Between paragraph 22 of Mr. Hanley's brief, talking about tolerance can vary from community to community, and paragraph 24 saying, well, you're concerned that the evidence expresses concern of a different criteria for natural hazard risk management in QLDC. I was left puzzled, saying, is there a contradiction there? If you're saying, well, tolerance can vary from community to community, but then saying, well, you can't have a different test in QLDC to CODC, for instance, what am I missing?
I saw the point you were making, too, and I was kind of part of where it's expressed. In general sense, there is that concern that that natural management of natural hazards should be relatively consistent, but within that there may be a range that which you feel the community is more tolerant in terms of what the risk may be. And I guess it's kind of a scale issue as much as anything else. And that such substantial areas here are developed, the natural hazard areas, and we accept that there may be situations where you want to intensify them. You have very little choice, and hark back to the point that Commissioner Nugent was making before, that there are a few other areas which are suitable for development where you can go. In other locations, it may be far better to avoid those. It's just a matter of where that tune in terms of those policies. think the flexibility is more a matter of, you know, the case-by-case type assessment, and that's how you actually enable that sense of, okay, where are you managing the risk and the appropriateness. There are some areas we would say are high hazard, and we think the developer should not go there at all, really, and that would be very much a matter of avoidance. But in other situations, it may well be possible that you can mitigate them, and that's really that, that where that sense of the case-by-case and the risk
focus. So, the sense I get from your answer is that Queenstown Lakes has particular demands posed by effectively the pressure for growth, and that might lead to conclusions that perhaps wouldn't be reached in other districts that have less demand and greater options as to how to accommodate what demand they do have. Now, there's an issue about in terms of objective 28.3.1, Mr. Hanley's table. You, as you observe, the term minimised is currently used in the proposed RPS. The recommendation we're from in the 42A report is it should be, I think, avoided or appropriately managed to tolerable levels. And you've said, well, we should use whatever term is resolved through the PRP. The proposed RPS process. Now, you may get a mediated answer through the RPS process, but on the basis that this council will be looking to make decisions potentially before we have the benefit of the Environment Court's determination on the subject, where do you stand? What's your rationale? Do you support minimised? Is minimised appropriate in an objective related to natural hazards?
Well, that's been council's position, that minimised is appropriate.
I understand that it's council's position because I can read the RPS, but in terms of, I'm trying to get to understand, well, why is minimised appropriate in your view?
Well, as opposed to, like you said, the context there as opposed to mitigated.
Yeah, as opposed to appropriately mitigated.
Well, that would be my understanding, which I haven't had the benefits of Warren's kind of full analysis of that, but in terms of obviously avoiding is, you know, a higher threshold than that, and so the risk of hazards to community being avoided where possible is ideal, but mitigated implies that you won't be minimising the risk. To the same extent that minimising may indicate.
So it's a lesser standard, or potentially a lesser standard.
Mitigated.
Yes. Well, is it, like I'm trying to understand what you're telling me, right? And trying to crystallise it in my own words so I make sure I got it correct. So is that a reason why you think it's not appropriate?
Identified there as being minimised because that's a higher threshold than mitigated, and so that's why it's been indicated that's a better test to have in the policy, because if it's avoided or minimised, then that's a stronger test than avoided or mitigated. You're implying that any form of engineering may be appropriate, which we obviously is mitigation, so rather than trying to reduce the risk as much as possible, it's an indication that that's not a requirement, that some form of manufactured option may be equally
mitigated. Wouldn't manufactured and engineered solution also minimise the risk? Is that the whole point of engineers see that their life is poor?
Well, potentially, yes. I guess that's in terms of a means of minimising it. Yeah. But
I can't see that there's a difference then between minimise and mitigate.
Well, it may not be the only means of mitigating. Oh, minimising, sorry.
may not be the only means of mitigating either.
Minimising may not be the only means of mitigating.
No. Anything, I think what Commissioner Robinson is trying to get to, is there a distinction between minimise and mitigate? And I'm not sure.
Yes, I think there is.
You've explained how there is.
Well, mitigation is a means of creating something to, in this case, to reduce the risk. But minimising may not, maybe there's no risk, or less developed in an area which would be subject to risk in the first place. That wouldn't be mitigation as such.
Isn't minimising reducing the risk to the minimum level possible? Isn't that the exact meaning of the term?
Yeah, minimising, okay, sure.
And mitigate means reducing the risk. You can't go lower than the minimum level possible, can you?
To mitigate is to actually apply another mechanism to do it, I must say.
No. The meaning of mitigate is to reduce.
Well, if that's the definition.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, thank you. The last point is we had the query we had as regards your opposition on the current recommended provisions in 28.324, which is soft solutions over hard solutions, is whether, in fact, there is status, ORC has status in its submission to suggest that relief, and or indeed whether we have status to amend it at all. And so I'd invite you to comment on that if you're able to. Because while we have a legal obligation at the moment to have regard to the proposed RPS, we can only amend the PDP if we have submissions that give us that scope. So the question is, does the ORC submission give us that scope? And if not, can you point us to what other submission might do that? Thank you. That's all I have. Thank you.
I have no other questions.
Thank you. That makes for sure, aren't you?
I will resume the hearing for 2:30 on Monday.